Okay, good evening all. We are at 7:30, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. Just a reminder, we are recording, and the recording along with the deck from tonight and the chat contents will go up on the website later on this evening. I will mute all right now, and you do have the ability to unmute yourself. Please remute yourself after making any question or comment to keep background noise at a minimum. You can also use the chat window to enter any questions or comments. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Welcome, everyone. We have a lot of material tonight, so I'll get right to it. I'm going to start with a follow-up from an item last week. You may recall Bob was talking about portable hard drives. And Bill had asked whether you could use such a hard drive with a tablet, and Bob thought you could. So, with a bit of research and a bit of experimentation, if you go to this website, this How to Geek website, he tells you that most modern Android devices will support USB drives, so you can just plug it in, more or less. What you need is a USB OTG cable, an on-the-go cable, which gives you a regular USB to a micro USB adapter. You also need to format the drive to FAT32 if it's like Bill's using old drives. So if it had been formatted to NTFS, Android doesn't support NTFS, or at least not without a lot of work. But with an OTG cable or adapter and a drive formatted to FAT32, you can then connect it to a tablet. Now, the question Bill had was, why do you have to use an OTG adapter and you can't just use a USB charging cable? Because a charging cable has a regular USB connector at one end and a micro USB at the other end. The problem is that if it's a purpose-built charging cable, they only have two wires, power wires, plus and minus, for the voltage. Whereas if you have a data cable, it has four wires. It has two wires for voltage and two for data transfer. So clearly, if you just have a charging cable on its own, you've got no way to send the data down the pipe. But there's another wrinkle, the OTG system. The micro USB actually has five pins. So it has the two power, the two data, and then there's a fifth pin, which they call the ID pin. And depending on how that's connected, it determines whether that end of the cable is going to act as a host or whether it's going to act as a peripheral. And the USB controller on the main device is going to sort all that out once it sees the electrical state of that connection. So the OTG adapter then basically allows you to connect an Android device, i.e. a smartphone or a tablet, connect it to a keyboard or a mouse. You can connect it to a printer, USB printer, or, as we want to do here, connect it to a flash drive or a portable USB drive. And as I've just said, with the electrical connections, OTG provides this dual support for a host or a peripheral. So if you have the smartphone connected to the drive, then the drive is going to act as a peripheral. It doesn't have any smarts, but the phone will then look after transferring files back and to between the phone or the tablet and the actual drive. However, not all Android devices support OTG, so you also have to make sure that you have a device that will support that. And finally, if you're going to use a drive, for example, then the device that you're using, the tablet or the phone, has to provide enough power to actually, to actually access the drive. And if that's not the case, then let's say you've got a big external drive, then you probably have a power brick, which is giving you an external power supply. Bill's system was basically, he had a couple of drives. He had an 80 gig USB drive and a 750 gig drive. And these are standard portable type drives with just USB connectors. And he also had a cable lying around, and he also had an LTG cable lying around. So here's the way he connected it up using this this double cable. This is what you would normally use to power something like a portable CD drive, let's say, from a laptop. You put both of the regular USBs into the laptop, and that gives you enough power. And then the second USB is also doing the data connection at the same time. However, in our case, we need a regular USB cable, but then we have to hook it up to the OTG cable to give us that host peripheral connectivity. So here's the final result. Here's the tablet on the left and the drive on the right. And I'm told that Bill was successfully able to copy files back and to. So if you have a drive and a tablet or a phone, you need a cable and a FAT32. Okay, that's it for that. Anything else?
Nothing. Tom mentions you can use Bluetooth keyboards for the phone. Yeah, but we're talking about storage here as opposed to keyboards. He said double connectors used to be necessary with USB 2. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, Bluetooth would certainly work for things like keyboards where you can use wireless connectivity. But, you know, you can also use a cable if you've got a cable lying around. Okay, our next item is a share, and turns out Linda has bought herself a fancy new piece of kit and wants to tell us all about it.
Okay.
Linda, you should be able to take over screen sharing.
Okay.
That's got your desktop. There we go.
Yep. Okay, so just before we get into the nuts and bolts, I just wanted to let you know what the experience was in trying to purchase this Google Pixel 6 Pro. I done my research. That's the model I wanted, and I wanted to stay with Virgin Mobile. So I thought, well, you know, it was the weekend and Chris was over. We thought, well, let's just go to the website and purchase it. Should be pretty straightforward. You know, there's got to be someone out there willing to take that amount of money. But no, so we went to the website, and there was a spot that you could purchase the unit, the device. But as I got further through the menu system, I realized they were trying to add a second phone, and I was trying to upgrade from my phone. I didn't want a second phone. So we got going on the chat, and the guy, you know, was trying to sell me a better package. And then he tried again and finally said, well, it'll be worth your time to hear these specials. And I wrote back and I said, you have no idea what my time is worth. So how would you know? So he said, sorry. And he sent me over to the sales department. We chatted with them for a while, and then they said, go to a store. So all this to say, you know, no matter how much money you really have to spend on a weekend, not necessarily is there someone there to take it. So we went to the store, and they would not allow me to buy it outright, but they did give me a pretty good plan. So this is the phone itself. Just to give you some dimensions, it's a little bit longer than the phone I had, which was the Samsung Galaxy S8, and a little bit heavier because there's three camera lenses in it, and there's a heavier battery, I believe. It's got 128 gigabytes of internal storage and 12 gigabytes of RAM. And it uses a 30-watt charger, so I bought one because I didn't want to have to wait 8 hours for my phone to charge, but I guess you wouldn't absolutely have to do that. What I really like is it's pure Android. So when I had my Samsung, there were all these Samsung apps that you can't uninstall. And I never used any of them, but I couldn't get rid of them. So on this, there's nothing. It's just a few Google apps that I would have used anyway, Google Play Store, things like that, Google Maps, et cetera. So I really like that it's clean. So the cost of the phone is $1,179, and what I did was I ended up buying it over time because that was the only way they would sell it, and it didn't work out to be any more expensive than if I'd gone to Amazon, because they gave me $100 for my trade-in on my old phone, which I would never have gotten around to trying to sell that myself personally. So that was good. So it's over 24 months, and then the charger cost $45, which sort of ate into the trade value. And then the monthly fee is $41 for 4 gigabytes of data, which is all I need. Good speed, free long distance in Canada, and unlimited international texts, which I had before. So a very seamless transition. The lady there plugged my Samsung into the Google Pixel, and everything got transferred. And she did a bunch of things for me. It cost $50, so there was the other half of my $100 trade in value, but that's okay. It was money well spent. I walked away and everything was working fine. I just had to do some, custom setups as per usual. So main thing I want to share with you today, because that's what I bought it for, is the camera features. And of course, y'all know that's my interest. So that's what I'm going to focus on today. So there are three lenses within the camera. There's the 24 millimeter, kind of equivalent to the old 35 millimeter cameras. 24 millimeter, that's your primary lens, and it's got image stabilization, which I like. They also have a ultra wide setting that you can put on, which helps for indoor situations where you want a really wide angle. There are two tele lenses, and they're basically 51 millimeter or 102 millimeter equivalent. They call them 2x and 4x optical zooms from the primary. Now, optical zoom is really what I was wanting to get, because my old phone, while it did a great job of taking pictures, there was the only zoom it had was your standard digital zoom. And for those who don't realize, that's just cropping. So you're just losing megapixels. Whereas with the optical zoom, it's kind of like your old point and shoot cameras often had 2x or 4x zoom. And therefore, you're maintaining your megapixels all the way to the end of your zoom. And it has your image stabilization attached to it, which is great. But speaking of megapixels, the way it's advertised for the three lenses is 50 megapixels, 48, and 12. Just ignore these. It's just sales hype, because they do this thing called binning, and Chris is going to put in a brief description of it in the chat. But it outputs to 12.5 megapixels no matter what lens you use to take the picture, and it seems like other phones do the same thing, but they all advertise these large sensors for the camera lenses, but they all output this 12.5 megapixels, which is funny for what I wanted to do. Screen resolution's good and has extensive shooting and editing features. So here's the first shots that I took out my front door. So you can see this 0.7 is the sort of wide angle that you can set it to. The 1x is the primary lens. 2x is the zoom, and 4x is the largest zoom. So I'm across the street. Now, yeah, you're not going to use it for bird photography or something like that, unless there's an albatross sitting on that roof, you might see it, but not for small birds. But then, I've got a 4x zoom picture, and I've still got my 12.5 megapixels, so I can crop it from there. And I could probably crop down even more and still have a fairly clear image. So maybe a robin or something big. Okay, so then I wanted to know what kind of close-up I could take. So this is a close-up that I took with the standard lens, the primary lens, and I was about 4 inches away from the tuning. And then I thought, well, I wonder if I can zoom from here. So I used the 4x zoom, and then I got this image on the left with the 4x zoom, but I've still got my 12.5 megapixels, so I could crop in. I could probably crop in even further right in the phone. And still have lots of clarity when you do that close up plus zoom plus crop. So that makes me happy. So this is just a close up using something a little prettier. Some of the close ups, depending on whether I'm shooting with the zoom or the primary, I don't always like the bokeh in the background. Sometimes it's a little crunchy. I would never take my phone if I was going to go take close-ups of flowers. Say I was going to go to the arboretum or the ornamental gardens. But if I'm in somebody's house and they say, come see the flowers in my backyard, I would be more than happy to take a picture with this phone, a close-up of a blossom. So then I wanted to try portrait mode, but I live alone, so I didn't have anybody to take a portrait of. So I decided to take a portrait of my kettle, and I'm very close to my kettle because I'm a tea drinker. So I took this just with the standard non-portrait mode. That was just the standard mode. And then I took it with the portrait mode, and you can see, as occurs in other phones that you may possess, the portrait mode just softens the background a bit. And that's really nice if you're taking a picture of someone in a restaurant and there's all sorts of you know, people walking by in the background or clutter or bright colors or whatever. So very handy feature to have. And then I can set it on the motion dial or button. And so I took this picture of this moving car. And then what the camera automatically, you don't have to do anything fancy. It just automatically gives you two pictures in your photo gallery. And the second picture is this sort of panning effect. Now you can see they've sort of streaked the background, but they've also streaked a little bit of the front end of the car and a little bit of the back. This is the area they've kept in focus. So I don't know exactly how they choose or what they use, but it's kind of neat. And then this is their long exposure. Again, you just hit a button, and I wasn't close to any pretty waterfalls. This was just some spring runoff near the river. So I took a picture. It was fairly dark, so it didn't have a really fast exposure, but it took this normal exposure, and then it automatically created this second image with a softer look to the water. Again, I wouldn't use this if I was going to go out take pictures of waterfalls, but if I had happened to have it in my pocket and wanted that effect, I could get it. So what interested me too, because these were more than what I had in my old phone, was adjustments while you're taking the photo. I had lots of adjustments after, but these were adjustments while taking the photo. So the overall brightness, like you might have your EV adjust in a standard camera, you can adjust tint, shadows and highlights, which is kind of cool. So if you've got somebody backlit and you want their face to show more, don't worry about fixing it after, just adjust the shadows before you take the picture. Same with the highlights, you can darken the highlights down. It will overlay grids for the rule of thirds, but also the golden ratio if you prefer that. You can use a level for horizontal and vertical straightening, and you can straighten after, of course, but the level is nice for when you're actually taking the picture. And the point of focus is cool. So if I put my finger on the screen and say, this is my object of interest, I can then move the composition around and maybe not have it in the center, put it off to the side, and the camera remembers that you want that as the point of focus. I haven't tried focus tracking when the object is moving. I haven't played around with that yet. I don't know if it works or not. You can shoot RAW and JPEG, which is nice. I'm going to work with that because I find some of the JPEGs are kind of overprocessed, in my opinion, as they often are with cell phones. But so if I've got the RAW as well, then I might be able to do my own editing. It's really hard to pull back from an overprocessed JPEG, so this will be an improvement over my old phone, hopefully. So editing features, so cropping, straightening, that kind of thing. But what I was gaining on this one was you can crop on this phone to a standard size for print. So rather than just a freeform crop, you can crop to 4x6 or 8x10. So it's all ready. You could send it to someone or send it to, you know, up to, I guess, a website, get it printed, whatever. So that was kind of nice. Perspective control is when you're shooting up at a building or whatever and the sides kind of bend in parallax there, and you can adjust for perspective control in this phone, and not all phones will do that. Smart erasure is kind of cool. I'll show you how that works. And the background blur. The background blur, as I discovered, does not work on a portrait of a kettle. It only works if you have a person or an animal in the image, and I guess they're looking for eyes. If you take a picture that they don't think is a human or an animal, that blur menu doesn't even appear. You don't even know that it's there, that the option doesn't come up. And then there's lighting and color adjustments, and they've got a dynamic contrast tool, which I quite like. It's not overly heavy. It's kind of nice light touch, so I probably will use that. So I didn't think I didn't have it. I just thought I had a picture of my kettle, but I remembered I'd taken a picture of my new dance outfit to send my sister that morning. So I thought, okay, I've got a picture of a human. We'll see what it does in the blur setting. Now, this blur setting, you can adjust. So that was about halfway. I could have made it less. I could have made it more. But I don't like it to look too unnatural. And I'm sure if you zoomed in tight, you'd probably see the edge might not be really, really perfect as you might do if you were masking it yourself. But not too bad. And my sister, it was definitely good enough for my sister. Okay, the magic eraser. So I just sort of balled up this napkin and threw it on my couch here. And I thought, well, that's a pretty big object. It's not like I'm trying to just get rid of a very small spot. So I hit the magic eraser and poof, it was gone. You just tap the little object you want to have disappear, or you tap and drag if it's bigger than your finger, and it's gone. So that was nice. So then, as you're looking at your photo in your gallery, you can, instead of going to edit mode, you can go to Google Lens, and this allows you to do search. So when I hit the search button, it took the photo from shooting across the street, and it automatically said, oh, you might want to know what this tree is. And so that's kind of cool, because if I'm walking around my neighborhood and my neighbor has a shrub and I don't know what it is, which species, Google Lens will help me with that. And the same with, and then it picked out the truck and asked me if I wanted to learn anything more about that particular truck model. So then you can also hit the shopping tab. So I'd taken this picture of a lemon. So then it tells me where I can buy lemons, how much it's going to cost. And I love this one, a factory direct, $2 for an artificial lemon. You never know, you're going to need an artificial lemon. So it kind of cracked me up. Okay, and then Google the Pixel 6 Pro Translate. So I had a French book I was reading. My French is nowhere near perfect, but when I did the translation, I read through it. Seemed good to me. I don't know why it has all these different fonts, but it does. But, I mean, all these things are available for downloading that, but it's just so nice to have everything really handy right in your phone. You don't have to think about a separate app or uploading it anywhere, so it's kind of nice. So one of the things that the reviews have stressed on this phone is its ability to do night photography. And for me, probably 80% of the photos I take with a cell phone are low light situations. That's, I use them indoors. I use them, you know, pre-dawn. I use them at night. If we're going out to dinner, I don't, when we're traveling, I don't want to take my camera. I don't want to lug my tripod. I just want to have maybe some nice pictures. We walk down by the water after dinner or something like that. So I was interested that it had good ratings on the night photography. It's supposed to be good for night videography. I have not tried that. And it's got a voice enhancer, so it reduces the background noise if you're speaking while you're doing your video. So here's a picture I took. It was quite dark. I was quite zoomed. That's a 4x zoom. It was dark. All the lights were on. And this gentleman was walking, but you can see I got it 1/25th of a second. He wasn't running, so he's still in pretty sharp focus. And so that was, you know, as I say, it looked brighter than my naked eye was seeing it. And then he came closer, and I got permission, and he kept walking. And with the no zoom, I got 1/60th of a second. So he could have been walking even faster. Now you see this off in the background, this little play area. So that's my next shot. I zoomed in. So 4x zoom again, 1/25th of a second again. And this girl was actually running. She just caught a soccer ball and she was running back towards her mom. And this guy was mid flight in the swings here. So it captured enough of the motion, a little bit of blur, but not too much. And what I like is there isn't a lot of noise. So if I tried to duplicate this with my standard camera, especially zoom, I would have had it wide open. I would have had a really short depth of field. My ISO would probably have bumped up. I would have got a lot of graininess. So that's why I really do love the cell phone for night photography. And now I've got an ability to zoom. So I'm happy. And then I just added a little bit of that dynamic contrast. And as I say, it's a nice light touch. It clarifies things a little bit, but not overly so. And I think that is the last slide. Yes. So I will stop my share and put it back to the game.
We did have a comment from Tom about let me go back to it. He was saying that the I can't find the one it is right now. Only one telephoto, 104 millimeter, 35 millimeter equivalent. I replied back that There is that two-time setting. So basically, you do the 0.7, 1, 2, or 4 times. And so I'm not sure what lens and sensor is taking the 2 times, whether it's
From the notes, it did look like the primary does the wide angle and the 1 time, and then there's the second lens for the 2 time, and then the third lens for the 4 time, from what I can gather with the specs.
Okay. And Lawrence commented that in your shopping, somebody wanted $145 for a lemon.
Maybe it's one of those lemonade vehicles that, you know, you see on the fairgrounds.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe it was for a bushel or something like that.
yeah.
Tom mentioned that the Magic Eraser, most of those features are in Google Camera app for recent Androids. So yeah. If you're not up to date on your camera app, you might be able to get it on other Android phones as well. Mm-hmm. Although I think a lot of the Google Camera, a lot of limitations on older phones for sure, that the latest Google Camera wouldn't work on it at all. And then I think that's it. If I missed anything, jump in, anybody else with comments or questions.
Allison says she and her son switched from Samsung Galaxies to Pixels a couple of years ago, and she really likes them.
Yeah, I switched as well to the Pixel 6. I didn't go to the Pro. It was about $380 more expensive for the Pro, and the standard 6 had everything that I wanted. And I've been very happy with it. I was getting really ticked at Samsung with all their apps that they foist on you and you can't remove them. And my battery life was starting to really suffer. And so I decided it was time for a new one. I'd already decided that I was probably going to be going Pixel a couple of years ago. I figured it would be my next phone. And so when Linda bought the 6 Pro, I jumped in, bought the 6. And I'm finding it very, very nice. I like the pure Android experience, and the quality of the phone seems quite nice.
I also bought the Pixel 6 when my Pixel 3 took a nosedive onto the road. I find that since then I've bought 2 of the original Pixels for under $100. And Pixels are nice because they, like you say, they're standard. The main difference between the, there are two differences as far as I can see between the Pixel 6 and the Pro. One is the telephoto lens that the Pro has, and the other is the display. The display is a bit finer. It's instead of HD up and down, it's something like 1440 up and down. And it also runs at, I think, 120 hertz. It can run at 120 hertz as opposed to 90 for the Pixel, which may make a difference in games.
And the base model Pro comes with 12 gigs of RAM, and the 6 comes with 8 gigs of RAM. Okay. That's a difference. And I think you can go, I think the 6 can go up. You can pay for higher level models that will match right up to the maximum. The 6 Pro will do, but the base models are a little bit less. But that was fine for me. I mean, I came from a phone that was 3 gigs of RAM, and so going up to 8 gigs of RAM with a much more powerful processor. Same processor in both the 6 and the 6 Pro. Much more powerful processor, and I find so much stuff on the phone is just a lot quicker than it was with my old Galaxy S A5.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that goes for quite a few people on the chat. Lots of people like your presentation, Linda, and if you're on commission, I think you might be in with a chance. Yeah. Okay, moving along, Bob Walker is going to tell us all about everything he knows about USB drives, I believe. So here we go.
Okay, let me get the share screen going here.
We can see it.
Okay, and okay, everybody seeing the proper view
yep.
here?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, since I switched to Office 2019, it seems to come up different every time. Okay, I'm gonna cover some useful info here on USB flash drives. The USB flash drives or USB sticks, USB thumb drives, jump drives, USB keys, and probably several other names as well. These are great to use for storing digital files, and they've pretty much replaced CDs and DVDs as the preferred storage media of choice. The flash drives are portable, durable, and some of them have really incredible storage capacity. Currently, there are several drives with 512 gigabytes, and there's 1 terabyte drives starting to appear. The flash drives can be used for storage and transport of data, and this can be almost everything, documents, pictures, videos, your application installation software, firmware update software, all sorts of stuff. You can use a USB flash drive as a boot drive, because most PCs will allow you to boot from a USB drive. And you can launch the operating system from a bootable flash drive. And Alan has covered this a few times in using Linux on your Windows PC. The flash drives can also have your software applications right on them, and you can run the application without requiring the application to be installed on the host computer. Now, you can't do this with all applications, particularly something like Microsoft Office, but it's useful in the applications that it can be used on. The flash drives can also be your installation media for your operating system, and you can use it for backups of data and backup images. Okay, many of the USB drives, especially those from premium manufacturers like SanDisk and Kingston, they come with backup, encryption, data recovery, and other software. Now, if you already have some of this software you're already using on your other devices, just keep using that. But if you're sitting there wondering, geez, I'd like to encrypt this flash drive and you don't have anything else, the stuff that it comes with is just great. Solid-state drives and SD cards that use similar technology, the life expectancy of a USB flash drive is largely dependent on the number of write cycles and the number of erase cycles. Typically, the USB flash drives can withstand between 10,000 and 100,000 write and erase cycles. And this is largely dependent on the memory technology used and the quality of the manufacturing. A cheap drive will, you know, if you get to 10,000, you're lucky. A premium drive, you'll get a lot more cycles out of it. And just to note that the read-only cycles don't cause nearly as much wear and tear as the write cycles and the erase cycles. If you simply write data to a USB flash drive and put it away in a safe place for 10 years, it will in all likelihood work again, and all the data will still be there. But if you continue to use it over and over and over again, it will wear out eventually. As with any flash storage, which includes solid-state drives and SD drive, cards, data loss may occur due to a prolonged lack of electrical power. So if you've had this thing sitting on the shelf for 20 years, it may have lost its memory. So flash drives aren't necessarily the tool to use for long-time archiving of data. The ultimate long-term life of flash drives is expected to be 10 to 100 years. And again, that depends on the quality and a lot of other factors. And of course, the 100 years is an extrapolation based on all sorts of things because there are no 100-year-old flash drives. Now, unlike spinning drives, your classic hard drives, which are more likely to fail gradually or at least give you some warning, solid-state drives, including USB flash drives and SD cards are more likely to fail suddenly and catastrophically. Another note is that do not defragment the solid state drives. This causes excessive wear and tear, and there's no advantage to doing it. Defragging is for the spinning drives. You get what you pay for. Cheap USB drives are great for limited use or for giveaways. If you plan to subject a USB drive to heavy use, buy a premium model from a premium brand. And keep in mind that even some of the premium brands have budget model lines that are lesser quality than their top-of-the-line drives. And some brands offer ruggedized lines with features like rubberized housings that make them more resistant to shock and physical damage, as well as being water resistant. And I put a picture there of Patriot Memory's Supersonic Boost XT ruggedized drive with the rubberized cap on there. It's pretty much waterproof, but don't take it scuba diving with you. Beware of unknown brands offering high capacity, like 1 and 2 terabytes for ridiculously low prices, like $35-$40. These are typically low capacity USB drives whose memory controller firmware has been modified so that they can emulate larger capacity drives. For example, a 32 gigabyte drive being marketed as a 2 terabyte drive. When you plug these into the computer, they report themselves as being the larger capacity they were sold as. But when data is written to them, either the write fails, the drive freezes up, or it overwrites existing data. Now, I had an experience, saw an ad on Facebook for a 2 terabyte drive for, I think it was $35 or something. And I decided, well, let's see what this is all about, because that wasn't a great deal of money. And what I got in the box was a 32 gigabyte Kingston memory drive still on the display card. And the price I paid was a fair price for a Kingston memory 32 gig drive. And in the box was an instruction sheet written by somebody whose first, second, and maybe even third language wasn't English, explaining how to format the drive to 2 terabytes. Which would have ruined it. They give you an actual real working drive, so you can't claim to PayPal and Facebook that you got ripped off. And so it makes it harder to get your money back. And just a note, there are several of these fraudulent drives on Amazon, which is disappointing that they haven't taken these off, and on Facebook, which is no surprise I haven't taken it off. Okay, to care for your USB flash drive, you want to treat it gently. Keep it cool, keep it clean, and use the cap when when the drive isn't plugged into a device. When you remove the drive from your device, you should use the safely remove hardware and eject media feature that's in Windows 10 and some of the other Windows versions. And you should try to avoid power failures. And to do that, you can either use a UPS or uninterruptible power supply. And there's a link down at the bottom there because I gave a presentation on these a while back. Or use a laptop or a tablet with a battery so that if the power fails, it doesn't matter. I live out in the country. I have power failures all the time. And one thing I don't do is depend on things when there's a storm in the area, a thunderstorm, snowstorm, or whatever, because it's almost inevitable that there'll be at least a few power winkies. If you interrupt the write cycle, as a best case, you could lose the data that you're writing. And in the worst case, you could lose the drive altogether. You should keep some empty space on the drive. Don't use it to its full capacity so that your computer can practice what they call wear leveling, And this means that the computer will write equally often to all the available spaces on the USB flash drive to equalize the wear over all the empty cells. And just like every other drive, back up your flash drives regularly. And Alan and Chris have done several presentations on backing up and all that. So there's all sorts of information on the OPCUG website on this. Okay, we're going to have a quick look at physically small, high-capacity USB drives. These drives are great for use in laptops, so you can put the laptop in its carrying case with the USB drive still in place. You know, it's not sticking out 2 inches out of the side. They're great for other applications where you don't want the USB drive protruding out, and this includes some car infotainment systems. In some cases, there's very limited use or room for the drive. In one of my cars, for example, the USB drive is in the little storage thing there between the front seats. And if you put anything in and out of the storage area with a regular USB drive sticking out 2 inches, you can catch it and bend it and damage it. These drives are also great where the USB ports are stupidly close together, like on far too many laptops. I have at least 3 laptops where the USB ports are so close together, you can barely get even 2 of these small drives plugged in at the same time. Okay, a high capacity USB drive allows you to have all your current data in one place for easy transfer between devices. And we'll talk a little bit more about this on the next slide. So physically small and high capacity together, this is a great thing. But you got to be careful with these because they're very easily misplaced. Can't count the number of times that I've found misplaced one of these and found it later on in a pants or a jacket or a shirt pocket. Found one of them in the dryer. And occasionally lose them between the cushions of the my Lazy Boy. Okay, if you frequently use several computers, like let's say your personal laptop, your personal desktop, the computer you have at work, you have a tablet as well, you can use one of these high capacity USB drives for all the working files of all your current data as you move from device to device. And the way you do this is you can either use the file on the device or you can use the file on the computer. And before you remove the USB drive, copy the drive data to the back and forth from the device to the USB drive. And you can maybe do this using the an app like Free File Sync that Alan has featured in a couple of past presentations. Specifically, SanDisk has a line called the UltraFit. It's a USB 3.1 flash drive. They're very physically small, and they range in from 16 gigabytes for about $10.50 up to 512 gigabytes for $68. And these are prices from Amazon. I actually have a 512 gigabyte plugged into the laptop that I normally use, and it's great to have there. Kingston has a line called the Data Traveler, which are in metal cases. And you can see one there on a keychain. And they have 3 sizes of these, from 32 gig for $22, to 128 gig for $41.50. I put the sale price there because as of the 25th of April when I got these prices, the 128 gigabyte one was on sale for $36.65. Kingston has a line called the DT Micro Duo, and they come in a couple of different cases depending on whether they have an older or newer one. One side has a USB A connector, the standard USB connector, and the other side is either a USB-C or a micro USB connector. The flippable cover protects either the smaller connector, or on some of the models, you can flip it either way to cover either connector. So if you have it plugged into your smartphone with a micro USB or USB connector, the cover can protect the other connector. These are very useful for transferring data between your computer and your smartphone. You can get, there's several different USB multi-packs available, especially on Amazon, or in places like Staples or the Source. These various packs come with different quantities of drives, different drive capacities, and from all sorts of brands, from cheap to expensive. The prices can be as low as $3 a drive, and I wouldn't use the cheap ones for heavy use, but they're great when you want to give data to somebody on a drive, but you don't want to be all agonized and worried about whether you get the drive back or not. There's all sorts of novelty USB drives there. Out there, you can see in the upper right-hand corner, there's a USB thumb drive. All sorts of other different ones. And there's some more novelty drives here on the last slide. The Moose is actually a USB drive. You pull his head as a cap, you pull it off and plug it in. The one on the left with the Visa logo, that style of drive is quite popular with the flippable cover. All sorts of other ones. And that's it for today.
Thanks a lot, Bob. We have a number of comments in the chat, so how to detect fake ones. We have linked to our Q&A discussion on that, going back a little bit. Tristan has a link to a new rugged SSD. It's the Samsung T7. The Samsung portable SSDs are really sweet. I had a T5, and they are really, really nice. Small, light, virtually indestructible. Tom says you can use SD cards for portable storage and laptops. Yeah, a lot of laptops certainly have card slots. Alan pasted in the link to the recording from, it looks like, January 5th, where we talked about fake USB flash drives. Tristan put a link for a utility that allows you to use both data and bootable with multiple operating system ISO files. You can use an app, HDH, to test W to check the actual volume on a drive. And I think Alan pasted the link to that. Yes. Tristan commented the local shops, Memory Express, and on Merivale and Canada Computers, multiple locations, often have sales on quality USB sticks. And some thanks coming in from everybody. Tristan, be warned about novelty drives are normally made with the lowest quality parts that did not pass QA for name brands. Something to watch out for. Natalie asked, do the ones that you have to extend the plug part wear out faster?
The ones where you extend the plug, the entire USB key is actually in the plug. And the outer casing is just a plastic shell that the actual drive slides back and forth in, so should have no effect on the life. And there's several good quality drives that have that kind of case.
Okay, and I think Tom says USB 2 is limited to 30 megabytes per second, approximately. USB 3 is 10 times faster. I find for me personally, I don't find the speed of it really matters all that much. I'm not really using it that much. I never use USB flash drives to do basic operations on files, you know, actively. I use them as a transport mechanism only. I have nothing on my flash drives that don't exist somewhere else, and it gets backed up from that somewhere else. Tom says speed is more important for big files. Yeah, but still, I don't transfer them all that often on there. So, you know, for me, speed doesn't really matter all that much. But yeah, for your use case, could be different for sure.
Now, if you're using a USB drive as a backup, and you have a 512 gig USB drive, and you're using more than half of it to back up data from another source, the speed can be an issue.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where I found that the Samsung T5 portable SSD I had is really, really nice, lightning quick, and very handy.
Yeah, keep in mind that a lot of laptops might have three or more USB ports, but quite often only one of them is a USB 3 and the others are USB 2.
Yeah. Okay, I think that covers off things in the chat there. So thanks very much, Bob. That was really good. We had a lot of good information in there for people to think about. Bob's URLs on his slides, got pasted into the chat there as well. So if you're interested in any of his links, you can pick it up there.
And the slide will be posted to the website later anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving along, Stuart has an item here if anybody wants to find out the power that they're using in their PC.
Good evening, all. As it sort of indicates on the slide on the screen, I had a dead PC a couple of times, and before I ripped it apart and recycled everything, I thought, I wonder what's in all this, because it was given to me by a friend, and my friend thinks he's pretty hot with computers. I have my own opinion on that, but, you know. So I didn't know why the thing had failed. It simply wouldn't boot. I mean, the power supply would come on and a couple lights on the motherboard would blink, but it wouldn't post. Nothing would light up. I didn't really know. So I yanked out the graphics card and I said, what's this? And Googled it. And the manufacturer said, well, this thing needs, I don't know how many watts of power it required, but it was more than the power supply in the unit. And I thought, I better get a second opinion. And I started Googling and found this link to an article about power supply calculators. And the article has several with links to each. And the first couple were rather complicated and a little more oriented towards very modern, the newer components that you will find available. But the power calculator from the retailer Newegg would allow me to plug in the specs for ancient hardware. So I was able to put in, okay, this thing had an i5 second generation chip. I forget the exact model number, but, and a couple of memory sticks, and there was this graphics card and a DVD-ROM drive. What else was in that thing? Well, the SSD, what have you. Anyhow, the calculator told me that this PC would need approximately 340 watts of power. And my good buddy had given me a 250-watt power supply. Aha! So I figure that somewhere between the power supply and the graphics card, there is a fried resistor somewhere on the board, or a blown capacitor, or something that's been made into a scrambled egg. Anyhow, I salvaged all the bits of the PC that I thought were worth keeping. And I took the rest of it to Staples to recycle. If you're wondering about what you may need in your PC, a utility like Hardware Info, which is HWINFO, this will tell you very quickly exactly what is in your computer. And you can take that information and plug it into a power supply calculator and find out exactly whether you have too much, too little, or just the right amount of wattage going through your system.
Andy, it sounds to you like you should maybe do this before you build the computer.
Well, I was just going to say, if you're going to build one, as some people have indicated they would like to, this would be rather handy. And if you're wondering why your monitor is flickering and not working, or if there are flaky issues with your computer, this might help you identify a low power supply too. It's not about identifying a problem with the power supply. It's identifying whether the power supply is the right one for the job.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. I'm sure lots of people are going to be plugging numbers into that calculator. Okay, I think moving on, we have a share now from Chris.
Yeah, very quickly, this came out today. Microsoft Build 2022 has been announced. It's really a developer-focused conference, so it's going to be May 24th to 26th of this year. It's free, as it has been ever since they went online due to the pandemic. So the link is there, and I'll paste that into the chat as well. An interesting historical tidbit. Build at 2016, which went for over $2,000 US, sold out within 1 minute of the registration site opening. They since dropped in their popularity, I guess, and that since then, but it's certainly open for many, many more people on the web-only versions of it. So if you're a developer, you might want to check out Microsoft Build.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And moving along, we have a question for you.
Yeah, so this was came into the suggestion box email, and person used Bernard used EaseUS to do backup, and it is supposed to be able to send email notifications when you have either a successful backup or a failed backup. And on that screen where you set it up, there's a button to send a test notification, and it failed with an error message like that. Next slide. So it turns out that some email providers don't allow programs to send emails using your normal password that you would do to log into your email. They require what is known as an app password, and that'll be unique password that you use instead of your normal password. So Rogers, who is Bernie's email provider, is one of those. Gmail is actually another that'll do this as well. So the solution on that is that if you're email provider is restricting it, they will have the ability to generate app passwords. So if you just Google for Rogers app password or Gmail app password or Yahoo app password or whatever, you'll get a link to their website that tells you how to set it up. So one thing that's worth pointing out is that app passwords should not be required if your email program uses OAuth authentication. It's only if you're using your regular password on it. Next slide. And so, requires the app password, and seem to have duplicated some information on here. Sorry about that. So the screen here shows you how you set it up. In this case, it's for EaseUS to do backup. So the screen where you send your email notifications, you put in a server name, your port, username, display name, and your password, and whether you're using SSL or TLS. And so you use all the normal settings for everything except for the app password, and for that, you have to use the app password. So next slide. So how do you get an app password? This is Rogers. So if you go to their, if you search on them and you get to their website, it tells you how to do it. So you go to the sign-in page, and you just put in step-by-step. You go through this thing. It will generate this long, complex password. You use that, paste it into, in this case, the EaseUS to do backup, you put in your regular username, you put in the app password, and then magically delicious, everything works. So the URL is there, and I will paste that into the chat as well. And that's how you deal with things if you need to have an app password to send email from a program.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so the final item we have is a question that came in about setting up a mini series on smartphone usage. And the suggestion was we call it smartphone basics. I guess this is very much like our existing computer basics for PCs. So I put this out on the members forum and I had a response with a bunch of questions. And one of them was, how do you move frequently used links to the home screen? Well, I think probably a lot of people know how to do this, but if you don't, then there's a few tips here. Basically, when you tap on an icon on the screen, it opens the app. But if you do a long press, i.e. you tap on the icon, but now you hold your finger down, then typically that brings up some kind of action menu. And as with all things Android, that depends on the Android device, the manufacturer, whatever they've done to customize their version of Android, or alternatively, the version of Android that you're using, because different versions of Android have different options often. And here's the problem that we were talking about before. If you have a remove option, then that says just don't display the icon on the screen. And so that basically gets rid of the icon from your screen. If you have an uninstall option, then you can remove the icon from the screen, but what you're really doing is deleting the app from the phone completely. And the thing is, you don't get the uninstall app if it's a system app. And that's the problem we were talking about earlier with all these Samsung phones, where you've got all these Samsung loaded programs that you're not allowed to remove. But what you can do with them is to disable them. So if you don't have an uninstall, you should have disable. And that basically gets rid of the icon from the screen, again, which is what we might want to do. And it also kind of pauses the app. You can't use it now until you decide to enable it. It goes into kind of a wait state, if you like. And then finally, you have a kind of a drag and drop option. So when you're holding the icon down, you can now drag it and move it somewhere else onto the screen. If you want to add apps, one of the things you've got to do is find them. You can install them from the App Store, for example. But you may already have a bunch of apps already installed, and somewhere on your phone there's something called an app drawer. And again, here's where it depends on the version of Android. On my current phone, which is running Android 11, if I slide my finger up the display from the bottom, then it opens up this series of pages. You notice on the right-hand side here that the three dots indicate that there's three different screens which will display various installed apps. So that's where I could put apps on my home screen, for example, from the app drawer. All right, so supposing here's my phone, and I've got this app called My Files, which is a file manager, but I actually prefer to use CX File Explorer, which I've used previously. And then I've also got this app called Galaxy Store, which is the kind of equivalent of Play Store for Samsung phones. I don't use that very frequently, so I'd actually like to remove these from my home screen and replace the My Files with CX File Explorer, and then add the Writer Plus file editor, which I use fairly frequently. So here's the example of if I do a long press on the My Files app, you can see I get two options. One is to select and the other one is to remove. But you notice I don't get an uninstall. Whereas if I long press on CX File Explorer, I can either remove it or I can uninstall it. Because this is an app which I have previously installed from the Google Play Store. Because I installed it, I'm allowed to uninstall it. And then the next thing is, if I select remove on this My Files app and on the whatever it was I had underneath here, I get rid of both of them and I create some empty space on the home screen. So now what I can do is I can go and find an app that I want to put on the home screen. So here's my CX File Explorer. I do a long press And now I just drag the icon across and drop it in the empty space over here. So by doing that, I can completely customize my home screen to have the apps I want. Here's some kind of permanent apps down the bottom, and they persist as I go from the home screen to the second screen. And then I've got the apps I mostly use here, and the apps I use less frequently are on my second screen. And the final thing is you can do the same kind of thing with any file. But again, now it depends on the Android version. With Android 11, you actually have an option when you long press to move the app to the home screen. But if you're using an earlier version of Android, then you may have to use an app. And here's a newsletter article talking about this app called Shortcut Maker. So basically, you open up the app, and it gives you the option of selecting a file. But notice I could select a folder, or I could select a setting or a website link. And I can create all kinds of different shortcuts. So if I create a file, I browse for the file. I've chosen this file called vaccination.pdf. That was in the good old days when we had to show the proof of vaccination. And rather than pick the generic document icon here, I could click on this icon button and choose an image to use instead of that icon. So it's fairly flexible in terms of how you use it. Okay. I noticed Natalie says to save space, she likes to group some icons together so you get kind of an icon which looks like a folder. Personally, I don't really like that, but if that's what you like to do, then that's fine. I don't know, is there anything else there, Chris?
I was actually looking at something else on the. I think it's pretty much covered.
Okay, well, let's move on.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Natalie asked about using USB hubs. There's basically two types. There's passive and powered. A passive hub will get all the power for the USB devices you plug into it from the computer or the laptop or the tablet or whatever else you have plugged into it. And so there's a finite amount of things you can plug in because every device that you plug in we use some amount of power. The powered hubs generally have their own power supply, and the power supply to all the things you plug into it comes from the power supply, not from the computer or the tablet. That's basically about it.
Tom asked, how do you create multiple home screens? I find in most cases, certainly on Samsung as well as Google Pixel, if you just drag an icon to the right from your home screen, it will automatically create an additional home screen, and you can drop your icons there. On Google Pixels, if you remove icons from that additional home screen, it'll automatically disappear. On Samsung, I find you have to actually long press on the blank home screen. You'll come up with a series of ghosted of all your home screens, and then you're able to delete any blank one from there at that point.
Good old Android. You can never have too many standards, right, Chris?
Exactly.
Okay, well, we're over time, so let's move right along. And I'll just mention that on Monday, Linda is going to be doing her basic photo editing course, Tech Talk. So this is the last call for registrations. Remember, if you want to attend, if you haven't already registered, you have to send us your email, and then we'll send you the credentials for the Zoom session on Monday at 7 p.m. So if you're impressed on how to make a sofa disappear, Linda's going to tell you all about that in photo editing. And then our regular May meeting, a very special one, Gillian Villeneuve is going to be talking about MacBook Pro. This is the first time I think we've had somebody talk about Mac hardware at a PC user group meeting, so that should be interesting. And then finally, next week, we have another Q&A, so if you have any questions or topics you want to share, if you know everything there is to know about smartphones and you want to contribute to smartphone basics, then please feel free. And other than that, thanks to everyone for attending and presenting, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for coming, folks. We'll see you.
Thanks, Chris, for the presentation.
Yeah, let me know if you have any problems, Bernie, but it should work if you go to that webpage and just get an app password from Rogers, paste it in. I've run into this specifically with EaseUS to do backup on two computers, and having an app password worked exactly as advertised.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.